Welcome to the Holy Spirit's Curriculum of Joy podcast. My name is Wanako Oberhuber, and I'm your host. My guest today is Dave Combs. Hi, I'm so happy to have you here.
Thank you, Wanako. It's a pleasure to be here today.
As I like to ask the first time when a guest comes on the show, I ask, how did you come to see the world the way you do today?
Well, that's probably a long story in there someplace, but I grew up in the mountains of East Tennessee and here in the United States in a Christian family and around wonderful people in my small community in the mountains of East Tennessee. And I grew up in a Baptist church in East Tennessee with wonderful, church members as a larger family that looked after each other. And I was around music a lot. Tennessee, and as you may know, is a big music state in the United States. And everybody there seems to play some instrument. My mother and father both played the piano. My grandmother Combs, she was only about 4'8", but she could make some music. She loved to play her old, an instrument we call an auto harp. It's an instrument. In fact, I have her instrument here beside me for those that might be watching. It's this harp. It's basically a stringed instrument that has, you push a key and it plays a chord. But she could really play that thing. And so I grew up around music and church and just a wonderful family and church family situation in my early years. Went to college, got my math degree, physics minor, and I'm a technical oriented kind of person. I guess you probably wouldn't believe that from the technical difficulty we had this morning before we got on the air, but I love computers, and I started my career out as a computer programmer. But also at the same time, I was a part-time minister of music at my local church. So I conducted our choirs and the singing in the church. And it was just, that was my life until about 1980, when I was 34 years old. 33 years old, actually. And I wrote a song in 1981 called Rachel's Song. And that song ended up getting recorded and played on the radio, and it just took off. And that song changed my life, because that led to me writing more music, which, by the way, that was the first song I'd ever written when I was 33 years old. But I've written now over 120 songs. I've got 14 albums of recorded music that's played all over on the world now by streaming. You can find it on Spotify, iTunes, iHeartRadio, all of the streaming platforms that are available really around the world. And my music gets played thousands or hundreds of thousands of times every month. So I guess that's my introduction of how I began my life, and it evolved into now a lifelong love of music and being able to spread that music around the world.
So what is the message of your music?
Well, it's interesting because my music is all instrumental. So the message seems to come to the listener from the place in their life that they are. If they're in need of some comfort with, they're having a difficult situation with maybe a death in the family or some sickness or whatever, and they listen to my music, it gives them some solace and some healing and some calm and peace. If they're somebody's getting married, my music sometimes is used in a wedding. So it provides the happiness and the joy and that kind of thing. But the fact that it's no words, it has no language limitation. So it can be played anywhere in the world, no matter what language you speak, whether it's German or English or French or whatever language, the instrumental music can still speak to you. So I think it communicates very well, as music seems to be kind of almost the universal language.
Yeah, music certainly can reach everyone, right?
Yes.
Yeah, there's so many styles of music, so it's really, really fascinating. Yeah. So you grew up in this Baptist environment. You And then you became a technician. You got to go delve into computer sciences and actually programming and everything. And the love of music that you had established as a kid actually took over, and your music actually basically spread all over the world. And now you're, so that's really, really phenomenal. It must have been a big step for you. How did you cope with this transformation in your life? It must have changed everything for you.
It certainly did. Here I was working for a large corporation at the time. It was called AT&T, the old Bell system, which in the United States ran all the telephone part of all the telephones in the country. And so here I am with this very large corporation and a successful career. I've done I had risen in the ranks to manager level and had a great job. But this song changed my life in that every time I played this song, no matter whether it was on the radio or in person or however I played it, it really touched people's lives. And that kind of today we would call something going viral when it just takes off all over the place. Well, back then the internet had not been invented. So I didn't have that. I didn't have Google. I didn't have email, but we had radio and we had the regular, all we call snail mail, the post office that could deliver things. And I started getting letters from people all over the country who had heard my music on the radio. And it was, I'd never gotten any fan mail in my whole life. So I started getting these letters and they were encouraging me and telling me all these stories about how my music had changed their life, how I had touched their life. And in many cases, in a very dramatic way or a very personal way. And so the message came, it was clear to me that this song really had taken on a life of its own. It was reaching and touching people that I had no way of knowing that it would. And I think it was 1994, I wrote an article that appeared in a magazine that a lot of people will recognize. It's called Guidepost Magazine. In the United States, it was goes out to about 3 million people, subscribers. It's a magazine of really good, uplifting, wonderful spiritual stories of how people's lives are touched by it in different ways. Well, that article that I wrote in that magazine generated, Wanako, I got mail from over 10,000 people in about 10 days. I had to hire two people just to answer the phone. My 800 number they'd put into the article. So people started calling and my phone rang constantly. I had to hire two people just to answer the phone. And my mail was so big, I got 10,000 responses in less than 2 weeks. My mailman brought my mail in a great big 50-pound or so canvas bag that he couldn't even pick up. It was dragging it down the sidewalk to my house. So that really was the one where I realized this song is, and my music is bigger than me. My music is a gift that I was given. And now my responsibility as the recipient of that gift is to give it away or to share it with the rest of the world. No, it's like a minister feels like they have a message to deliver to their congregation or to the world, or a performer has a message to deliver through their singing or their playing or whatever. In my case, I felt and still do feel a strong need to spread my music around the world. And last year, a year ago, I published my first book. I wrote a book called Touched by the Music. And it's a book about all of these stories and how I came to write the music and how obviously all this thing with my music did not happen overnight. It's, as we said, it started with one song and then that song evolved into I'd written enough songs for my first album. And then I started selling my music, not through record stores or music stores or anything. I started selling my music through gift shops. You've probably, I'm sure all the people listening and watching this will have gone on vacation to tourist areas and you walk in a beautiful gift shop. And quite often when you go in, there's beautiful music playing. And in my case, I talked them into playing my music in these gift shops. And the people that would visit the gift shops almost always wanted to take that music home with them. So that's the way that I ended up distributing my music throughout the United States. And actually, it was in other countries as well, but mainly the United States. But now you can get my music anywhere in the world. You can buy, if you still have a CD player, some people don't even have CD players these days, but you can still buy a CD on Amazon.com. But mainly people stream my music on the whatever platforms that you use to stream music. You'll find if you do the search for the artist name that played all my music, his name is Gary Prim, P-R-I-M. And Gary is a wonderful musician that lives in Nashville, Tennessee. And he and I have recorded all 14 of the albums together. And so if you just search for Gary Prim or Dave Combs and music, you'll probably find that where some of our albums and music are located. Rachel's song is certainly the very first song, and everyone that's listening to this will want to go and listen to Rachel's song. And you can listen to that from my website for free. It's at combsmusic.com. And just right in the middle of the page where you go is a link that says play Rachel's song. Click on that and you're listening to Rachel's song.
What I thought, one of your comments about it that I think is really beautiful is that you said you realized that you needed to give your music to the world, right? And I think, in A Course in Miracles, it says, in order to keep something, you need to give it away. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you can't have it. So to
that's
own
exactly right.
Something, you have to give it away. So I think that's really, really remarkable that you discovered that through your music and through your vocational decision, right, to actually follow through with it. It's really, really beautiful.
I was very blessed to eventually, as the music kind of got bigger and bigger, the sales, you know, kind of exploded all over the whole country. I ended up with over 1,000 gift shops throughout the whole country playing and selling my music. And we were shipping out the tapes and back then it was cassette tapes too, the tapes and CDs. We were shipping them out by the pallet load. I mean, there were thousands of them that were going out to all over the country, and it was just an unbelievable. You know, I've heard letters from over 50,000 people now over the years about my music and how it touched their lives. And last year, when the pandemic. I guess, how long has it been now? What, three, coming up on 3 years? That's hard to believe. But when the pandemic first started, my wife and I were sitting down and on our sofa one evening, you know, we can't go out to eat. You can't go visit relatives. You're just, everybody knows you were just stuck at home. What are we going to do? And so Linda says, you know, all those 50,000 letters that we got in boxes down there in the basement, you know, we need to get those out and pick out the best ones of those and tell our story about what music has done for all these people and for us in particular. And she said, that book that you've been being encouraged to write all these years and you never have done it, I think it's time for you to start doing that. So I said, okay, I will do it. So that was like November 2 years ago, we were sitting down and I decided that I would start writing it. So I started writing my stories down. And if you've ever written a book or if you're a writer, you know that there's a lot to be learned about how to become an author, how to tell a story so that it's interesting and entertaining and informative at the same time. So I wrote down all my stories and I had a whole lot more stories that ended up in the book. And it was a nice problem to have when you have, you know, twice as many stories as it probably will need to fit in a book. So we winnowed them down to the right ones. And along the way, I was fortunate to meet a gentleman who I had admired at a distance for many, many years. And that's Jack Canfield. Jack Canfield, you may recognize, is the co-author of the Chicken Soup for the Soul books. Well, I got to meet Jack at one of his retreats. And we got to spend 3 days together. Well, Jack loved Rachel's song. First time he played it, he was just smitten with it. He said, I played it again. He said, I love that song. And I started telling him the stories about the music and how it had changed my life and how it had touched other people's lives. And he said, man, you really do need to write this book. And he said, and I'll help you do it. Said he gave me some great advice. And I said, well, Jack, if I get this book written, will you write the foreword to my book for me? I was going to nail him down quick. you strike while the iron is hot, right? And he said, well, Dave, you write it first and then we'll see. He wasn't going to make a total commitment up front. Well, make a long story short, I did send Jack the manuscript of my book, and he liked that as much as he did the music of Rachel's Song. And he was very kind to write the foreword to my book, which I very much appreciate. So the book was released this time last year. So it was 2 years ago that I started that process, got to meet Jack, and that kind of changed the trajectory of my life too. You know, when you have a published book on Amazon, that it was a bestseller there for several weeks on Amazon and it's done well. And people tell me it's an inspiring read. And I also have an audio book for those of you that like to listen to books. You can order the audio book and listen to me read it to you for 8 hours. It was quite an undertaking, but it was a real joy to write that book. And now I'm real pleased that people can read about my stories all around the world now.
Another interesting fact about you is that you've been sharing the message not only through your books and your music, but also through many different venues, including mine today. You've been really sharing. How has that felt for you? And what is the motivation to do that? Because it's amazing, you know, to speak with so many different hosts and share your message and let people know about it.
Well, I guess it was about probably around the first of this year, after had published my book in October of last year, and around January, February, I started being a guest on podcasts to tell the story of my music and my book and so forth. And what I found was I was really nervous to start with. I had never really done a whole lot of guest appearances, and I've been interviewed a few times in my life before, but nothing like we're talking about, where we're going to be sitting here for, you know, many, many minutes talking back and forth about our stories. And so I started appearing on podcasts. And what I found was I loved talking with these people, our hosts like you. And by the time the podcast was over, I felt like I really had a really good connection with the host. And I can tell you that many of those hosts that I talked with over the last year, and I've done close to 150 of these appearances now in the last year, many of those I consider a friend. I could pick up the phone or the email or the message right now and ask somebody for something or consult with them, and they would be happy to do so. So it was a way to meet and network with a whole set of people that there's no way in the world I would ever have met any other way. And they're fantastic people. I guess there's something about you folks that are hosts for podcasts. First of all, you have some gumption and some initiative. I mean, not everybody in the world is going to put on a headset like you have and put yourself in front of the camera and lay yourself out in front of the whole world to view. So those people have, you know, their entrepreneurial spirit, they're take action kind of people. And it's fun to be around and to make friendships and connections with those kind of people. So this past year of doing over 100 hours worth of interviews with people around the world, and some of them are literally around the world. I had to get up in the middle of the night, like 2 o'clock in the morning one time, just so I could be on a podcast from somebody in Australia. Cause you know, they were a whole 12 hours ahead of me. So, it is interesting, but it has been really, really fun. And likewise for today, I'm certainly enjoying this.
Yeah, I think it's a really amazing thing. I have also met so many people that I would have never met if I hadn't been a host, right, of a podcast. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think I would have met you any other way. And there's so many others.
Probably not.
So it's really fascinating. You know, you get to know these amazing people from all over the world. Right now, we're somewhere around 70 countries people are listening to the podcast. So it's, and I think it's spreading, so it will be more soon. So, yeah. So this connection to the music is, do you have a feeling from where the music is coming? Because you said it's a gift. And do you have a feeling you know where that gift is coming from? Or,
well, it, and I guess I do and I don't. My belief is that the gift can, for all of us, I think our gifts come from God. That's my deep held belief. And when I look at my family history, my parents, my grandparents, all that, when music was such a big part of their lives, and when you're a product of not just your genes and your genealogy, but you also are a product of your environment. And so my music came from my love of music, first of all, growing up in a church that was music at my home church in at Calvary Baptist in Irwin, Tennessee, was such a central part of the worship service. I can remember, all of us probably when we were little kids, remember singing the little choruses or something as you learned how to sing and whatever. But I remember also the awe and appreciation I had for listening to that adult choir sing. We had a Hammond organ and an organist, and we had a piano player. So we would often have piano and organ duets for an offertory in the worship service. And I love those because that music was just so beautiful. And then the choir would sing, and I love choral music. I especially love harmony, you know, four-part harmony, whether it's an SATB adult choir or a male quartet or a female quartet or duets, all those kinds of harmonizing and music. So I think when you grow up around music, it just becomes part of your body and soul. It's just part of you. And so that I think that my music probably comes from that lifelong love and exposure to that kind of music. And if you listen to my instrumental songs, of which I've written over 120, they're very melodic. They don't have words, but I have people that tell me they put their own thoughts and words into it as they listen to it. I had one lady, several people wrote to me and said, actually, please do not put words to your music. I thought, well, that's strange. And they said, because I want to put my own thoughts and feelings into your music, not what somebody else felt and when they wrote their words. And I thought, well, that's pretty perceptive. So I have honored that request. I have many, many letters. People would write me a letter and say, here's my poem or my words that I set to your music. And it was always very beautiful, very touching. And so it was that kind of a connection, but it was a disconnect from the verbal part of it. So, and now the fact that it's listened to all around the world. You know where the second most popular country to listen to my music is on streaming, believe it or not, is Brazil. Now, I don't speak Portuguese. I wish I did. And I'm sure there are some wonderful Portuguese and Brazilian people down there that I would love to get to know. But for some reason, they love my music. And I'm so honored and thrilled that they do, but they speak a whole different speaking language than I do. You know, and I have fans in Germany. I have fans in Japan and all around the world. So it's really a phenomenon that music comes from out of me from my spirit and my soul. And I love playing the piano. And I like to tell people that when I sit down at the piano to write a song, it's really me and the piano having a conversation. I will play some music. And sometimes the music will kind of, quote, speak back to me. And what's next? What should come next in this song? And so that's really how I wrote all of my music, was sitting at the piano, just having a musical conversation between me and the piano.
Yeah, that's a really beautiful thought as well, is that there's this dialogue or this conversation is taking place. So it's not just you, there's something more. whether you call it the piano, the instrument, or you were previously saying it's a gift from, you believe, from God, right? And this is, and I think it's really remarkable that we have so much to give, right? Because, you know, you're just a human being, right? Every one of us appears to be just a human being, but what is just a human being? It's so much more, right? And of course, in Miracles, it says we are all infinitely valuable in the mind of God. So there's no, you can't overestimate the value of anyone, right? It's not possible. What do you say to that?
Well, I think you're exactly right. You know, each life on this planet was put here for a reason, or reasons. And a lot of time people say, what was your reason for doing what you are? I think it's wrong to think of it as only one thing. God didn't put us here just to do one thing. He put us here to live a long life of accomplishing things, for helping other people and living a good life and being a good person. So, you know, my gifts that I have, whether it's, you know, a gift of, I like to make music, obviously, but I also like to do things with the computer. I like to do things with my hand. I've taken some sculpting lessons. I've done a few pieces of sculpture, and I like to draw pencil sketches of people's portraits, that kind of thing. I've done that. So there are different gifts that people have, and those gifts are there for a purpose, for them to share with other people. And that's just the way I look at it.
And I like to encourage people to share, because there's so many people who are holding back at being who they are and sharing it with the world. And I really believe that we all are infinitely valuable in the mind of God, as the Course in Miracles says, but we're all infinitely valuable. And so our messages are what we can share. When we allow ourselves to do that, right? And especially when it's a message of love, which is what I love, right? It's so, so important and so valuable. And that's why I really am happy when people are willing to share that, like you are, and there's many more, right? Luckily, otherwise I wouldn't have any guests. Yeah. That would be a shame, right? So your music obviously is encouraging people to hear something, right? Like you were saying, they get these thoughts and words that come to them. And I think that's a really, really important thing, is it looks like your music is opening up something in these people so that they can actually hear these things. Would you like to share an example of one of those stories that you have shared in your book, for instance, or somewhere else?
Sure. There's and chapter 21 of my book is about 20 some pages full of these little, I call them little short stories of people have written to me. One of the first ones I got was from a lady who was stuck in a traffic jam at Christmas time in Atlanta, Georgia. And she said, I was stuck in traffic and this Rachel song came on the radio and played, and she said, your music turned a traffic jam into a wonderful experience. So there she was, all tensed up with the traffic, and all of a sudden now she's all calmed down, and who cares if that light's, I'm going to sit here at this light for 5 minutes. I'm listening to beautiful music. So I thought that was just a one very, very short, but very pointed story. Another story I got was from a lady who had just finished her training as an emergency medical technician, an EMT, as we call it. And she and her husband were driving on the way home in New Jersey. And she said they were driving down their neighborhood street, and over on the sidewalk, she looked over and there was this elderly gentleman who just collapsed and fell on the sidewalk. Well, of course, now that she's a trained EMT, they stopped the car and she ran out to go over to the gentleman to see what was wrong with him, and was trying to comfort him. And while she was on her way over there, she heard this song come on the radio in on her car radio. And so she yelled back to her husband, turn up that music. Well, he did. And as he was sitting there, I guess on the street with the car door open right next to where the man was laying on the sidewalk, she said that music played and said I was comforting him, trying to see what I could do to help him. And she said by the time the song finished playing, he had calmed down and was breathing back to normal and was okay. And she said that was totally amazing. And she attributed the music and the calming effect that music had on him to really help him. I don't know if it saved his life or not, but it certainly brought him back to a more normal state of mind and state of physical condition. And so they went back home and called the radio station and asked them, what's the name of that song you were playing at 6:07 p.m. today or whatever? And they said, oh, that was Rachel's song. And so I guess it wasn't the first time he'd ever gotten a phone call about that music. So he sent them a copy of the music and my address, and she wrote that story and sent it to me. And that story is in my book. That was a really wonderful, special, touching story. I've had other stories from young people that decide, I want to get married to that song. And I've had Rachel's song played as the, not necessarily as the wedding march for the bride to come down the, well, I guess I have had some that walk down the aisle to that music. But quite often it'll be the music that's played, for example, when the mothers are escorted down the aisle for the wedding and that kind of thing. It's been played in a lot of funerals for people that was their favorite song. Their children would write to me and say, you know, I found my mom always loved this song and she wanted it played at her funeral. And would you send me the sheet music so that our pianist or organist can play it at her funeral? And I've done that many times. It's been played for every occasion probably that you can imagine. And those are just some of the stories. And you'll have to read them in my book in chapter 21 about the rest of them. But you better get your box of Kleenex out when you're reading it, because many of them will bring tears to your eyes when you read about somebody that's it's really touched them in such a spectacular way that it either may have helped save their life, or it was the last song they heard before they departed this life for the next.
Yeah, that's very touching. Very, very touching. Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the definitions for health is peace of mind. And you were speaking of how it brought peace of mind to people in situations where one gets really tense if one doesn't find peace of mind, right?
Right. Yeah.
So that's really beautiful. And actually, I think that's beautiful that the diversity of the situations in which people love to hear it, right? Have you asked yourself why people can enjoy it in these so different types of situations? It's amazing. You know, I mean, funeral, wedding, the same song, funeral, wedding, had an accident, yeah, and this and so on. That's amazing.
I have indeed questioned myself as to what is so special about this song. And I think the thing that's special about it is that I did not write it. I was given that song. And because I literally that evening in 1981, I came home from work, and as I almost always did, sat down at the piano to play something. That was my way of relaxing when I got home from work. That particular evening, I sat down at my piano, and when I started playing, I started in the key of C and just started, the first note of the melody is a C, and I played that, da, 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 and then I went to A minor, and I love the chord progression of C, A minor, F, and G. It's kind of a standard, it's kind of a rock and roll sequence, but it's also the sequence of chords of a lot of ballads and pretty songs. So the next chord was an A minor, and then I went to a D minor chord, da 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 dum, and then I went to G, da 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 dum, dum, then back to C, da dum, and then just a very simple melody that I was playing it, and it was as if I knew the notes that were supposed to be coming up next before I even played them, if that makes sense. It was, and so I know I didn't try to write this song. In fact, when I finished playing it, I loved the song, the way it sounded, and I would play it quite often. Couple of days later, my wife comes home from work, And she says, "Dave, what is the name of this song that I've got stuck in my head all day? I've been humming this." And she hummed a little bit of it. And I said, "Well, Linda, it doesn't have a name." And she said, "What? It doesn't have a name. You play it on the piano all the time." I said, "Well, it's just something, I guess, I just made up." So she got all excited and said, "Well, have you written it down?" I said, "No, I've got it. I'm not going to forget it. It's burned in my brain. I will never forget that song." She said, "Well, something might happen to you and that song would be gone. So I want you to write it down." I said, "Okay, yes, ma'am. I will write it down." And I did. And for those of you watching on the video, this I'm holding in my hand, the piece of paper I wrote it down on. And it's a lead, what we would call a lead sheet. And it's just the melody and the chords of the song. And it says it's in the key of C, just a very simple melody. And the chorus goes to F and F minor and then back to C. And it's just a simple melody. So I did write it down, but that wasn't the end of it. We tried to think of a name for the song and nothing we came up with fit. And then about 2 years later, some friends of ours had a little baby girl and they asked me and Linda to be her godparents. And so we went to the little girl's christening service, a private service on a Saturday. And we're sitting there in the church, just us and the family and the minister. And up at the front of the church on the platform is a beautiful baby grand piano right in the middle of the platform. Well, when the formal part of the service was over, I punched Linda and I said, "Hey, what do you think about me going up and playing this song on the piano in honor of our godchild, Rachel?" And she said, "Well, that sounds like a good idea." So I asked the parents and the minister if it'd be okay. Well, of course they said okay. So I went over to the piano, sat down, and I played the song. And I got most of the way through it, and I could hear in the audience some sniffles and clearing the throat. And I noticed that I had some tears running down my cheeks. It was a very emotionally powerful event in the first place, and the music just really turned on the tear ducts. So I finished playing it, and I looked over at little Rachel in the arms of her mother, and I said, "From now on, this song will be called Rachel's Song in her honor." And that is how it got its name. It was the perfect fit. It still is here some 40 some years later. And that's how the song got written and named. And those events, which seemed so not insignificant, but at the time, I had no idea how important those events would be in my life to come. And so those events led to a lifetime of pursuing my music and spreading Rachel's Song around the world. Now, Rachel's Song has been played millions of times all around the world and has touched, as we've already discussed, the lives of young people, middle-aged people, older folks. Everybody that hears it is seemingly touched by the music. Now, I would love to know, and I probably never will in this life, to know exactly why is it this little simple song is so powerful in terms of turning on the emotions and the connections with people that hear it. I'd love to know the answer to that, but it's probably a very complicated answer in the first place, but it does seem to do that. And I simply am just feel blessed that is the case. And I am a very fortunate person that I was the person that God chose to deliver that song to this world through.
Yeah, that's really important to recognize that it's a gift. I think that's really amazing, you know. And I think that's an important thing when it comes to art and to music. You know, where is it coming from, right? And this feeling that it's not of our own, right? Mm-hmm. But it's come to us, right? From something that is beyond what we've ever imagined that we could ever be, right? Or that we are, right? I mean, A Course in Miracles says we are love, right? We all are, right? So I guess the source would be that true self, right? Or that the God, or beyond the true self, the God, right? The creator, that which brought us into existence in whatever way that is possible, right? And it also speaks of extending love. That's our function, right? Is to and also to be perfectly happy. And I think this song and all the later songs, probably that song particularly, has brought so much out of you, the ability to be happy and to be willing to share, right, in this. And I think it's really fascinating how you were at first, you were leery about it, right? Like your wife had to tell you, do this, write it down, get it out there, get it on paper. We don't want to lose this, right?
Yeah. she was the one that told me, you know, now after it got its name, about 3 years later, I was working in Nashville, Tennessee with AT&T at the time. And Nashville, Tennessee is, of course, we call it the Music City, USA. It's everything music is in Nashville, I think. And she said, well, now we've got the song named and whatever, why don't you go and get a demo recording made of the song? Since you're working in Nashville during the week, I was on a huge, big project, and I was there Monday through Friday almost every week. And so I said, okay. So I said, I think I can probably find a studio since there are hundreds of them around. So on one evening after work, I was driving around Nashville, Tennessee, and looking for a studio to record record Rachel's song. And I was over in the part of Nashville called Music Square. It's a part where the Country Music Hall of Fame is located. There's RCA recording studios, the original that you can tour. And then there's BMI and ASCAP headquarters and all kinds of everything musical. And there were lots of studios around. And so it was about 6 o'clock in the evening. And so I was driving around looking for a studio. And I go down this one street called Roy Acuff Place. Now, Roy Acuff was a very popular, famous musician in Nashville, Tennessee. Everybody loved Roy Acuff. He was on the Grand Ole Opry and just a wonderful country musician. So the street's named Roy Acuff Place. And down at the end of the street on the right is this big building that had a kind of a barn-shaped roof. And on the corner of the street, it had a big water wheel. You've seen these old mills that have the water-driven water mills. And this had a water wheel that they'd transported from some old mill somewhere and planted it there on the corner of the street. And the name on the side of the building said, the Music Mill. I thought, well, okay, then maybe I've found the right place. So I pulled in the parking lot, and sure enough, there was a man sitting at a desk in the lobby. I went over, knocked on the door. He unlocked it and let me in. He said, hi, I'm George Clinton. Can I help you? And I said, oh, really? And it's not the same George Clinton that everybody thinks of as a country musician or the singer. This is a recording engineer. And unfortunately, George has since passed away. But anyway, this time he was introducing me to the music mill there. And he invited me in. I said, okay, well, George, I've never been in a recording studio before. And he said, well, you're in luck, because this studio is currently nobody recording right now. Normally that's not the case, but let's go into Studio A, the big studio, and I'll show you the recording studio. So I said, okay. So we went in there, and the big room where they do set up all the instruments and everything, it was the size you could put a symphony orchestra in there. It was huge. And over in the corner was a big 9-foot grand piano, concert grand piano, and drum booths around, and isolation booths for vocalists around the wall. And I said, wow, this is impressive. He said, come over here, let's go in the control room. Well, he opens this big soundproof door. It's about 6 inches thick. And he opens this big thick door, and we go inside this control room. First thing I see is the console. Well, the control console in a recording studio is where everything kind of comes together. This thing had about 30, I believe it was 32 tracks that you could record on, and lights and cables and buttons and switches, and it looked like something you could launch a spaceship from. It was impressive. And around the wall were all these, back then they had analog tape machines and digital tape machines and all kinds of equipment around the wall. And this great big thick glass picture window the engineer could look out onto the recording room where the musicians were. Soundproof, of course, and on each side was these big speakers. They called them the monitor speakers, so he could hear in really high fidelity all that was going on. So I said, wow, this is really impressive, George. how much does a place like this cost? And he said, well, remember, this is 1986. He said, this is $125 an hour plus engineer. In today's terms, that's probably over $500 an hour. So it was from a whole lot more money than I made per hour. That's for sure back then. So I was, I guess, a little surprised at the number. And he said, well, don't worry about it, Dave. He said, the guy that owns this studio owns a tiny little studio in a formerly rent house across the street. It's just a little two-bedroom house that they converted into a studio. And he said, it's $15 an hour plus engineer. I said, okay, I can do that, $15 an hour. So I said, okay, well, now what I need is a musician to play Rachel's song. It's just a simple little melody, and I just need a good, really good piano player to play it. Who do you recommend? He said, well, let me think a second. He said, there's this fellow named Gary Prim. He and I go to church together. He said, he's a wonderful studio musician, plays piano beautifully. He'll do a great job for you, I'm sure. So he said, let's go back over to my desk and I'll look up his phone number for you. So he did, and wrote the number down on a piece of paper and gave it to me. And I thanked him profusely, and I headed back to my hotel in Nashville to make a phone call to Gary. Now, you say, well, why didn't you call him on your cell phone? Ladies and gentlemen, this was 1986. Cell phones had not been invented yet. I had to make a landline call to Gary. So I get to the hotel room, call Gary, got his answering machine. He calls me back in about 30 minutes. And I told him what I needed, and he said, I'll be glad to do that. I said, well, what do you need, Gary? He said, all I need is a recording of you playing it. Just send me a cassette tape recording of you playing on the piano so I'll know what it sounds like. And send me a lead sheet. I said, okay, what's a lead sheet? I didn't even know the music lingo of Nashville, where lead sheet is what everybody starts with, of course. And he says, well, what is a lead sheet? And he said, oh, it's just the melody and the chords written out on some music manuscript. I said, oh, well, I've got that. And that's that original piece of paper I showed you earlier that I had written down my Rachel song on. Now I know it. That's a lead sheet. So I made him a copy of that. And as soon as I got back home, I sent it to him. And he lined up the studio a couple of weeks later for us to meet at that little studio. And we recorded Rachel's song. And what I got from that recording, I had no idea what I was going to get, but it was an absolutely phenomenal experience. He played the piano part beautifully, and then he added some strings, and he added some horns, and he added some electric piano, and all that blended together. And just amazing. It took him only about 45 minutes or so to do the recording, and I paid him his money, and he's heading back home. And the engineer mixed it all down to two-track stereo and gave me my master tape and made me some cassette tapes to take home with me. And that was how I got Rachel's song recorded as a demo. Now, the interesting thing is, when you listen to that recording from my website, combsmusic.com, and you, in the middle, it says play Rachel's song. When you play it, put your headphones on or something where you can really listen to it, because what you're hearing is the exact same demo recording that I got made in August the 22nd, 1986 with Gary Prim. Not been remastered, not been re-edited, nothing. What you're hearing is what I heard in my rental car stereo all the way back to the hotel that night from that recording in Nashville, Tennessee. I was blown away by the professionalism and the quality and the beautiful music that was made by a little simple song that I had written, that Gary turned it into a masterpiece of a recording that really, literally changed my life from that point on. Everybody I played that recording for loved it. It got played on the radio from a friend of mine who had a radio program locally. The radio station phones lit up. Everybody was calling into the radio station. What is that song you just played? Play it again. That radio station ended up playing my music, that song, every day, almost once an hour every day for the next year or two. I could not believe it. Neither could the station manager. He said, I've never seen anything like this. He said, this is amazing. And there again, that was another confirmation to me that this song was special and that I had to do something special with it. And that the fact that the people loved it and and it meant so much to so many people. And that was the beginning of this snowball run of this, of the song that is continuing even today. So that gives you a little background. And those stories I've just told are in my book. So if you want to read more about it, you can. But the book is called Touched by the Music, and you can find it on Amazon and anywhere in the world, I believe. So hope you enjoyed me telling the story of how Rachel's song got recorded.
Absolutely. And I'm going to open the floor to anyone who wants to ask a question. So if any of the listeners here wants to ask a question, please raise your hand and we'll be happy to answer as best as we can, right?
And don't be bashful. I'm ready to answer any questions about my music that you want to talk about. I love to hear from people.
We'll see. Maybe one of you will raise your hand later, but we'll continue with our conversation. So this, you were, it almost sounds as if you were guided to that studio. It doesn't sound like it was something that you had a conscious choice about, in the sense that you knew where you were going, right?
It's funny you say that, because when you read through my book, I describe these kind of events as, I can't say I'm the originator of the phrase, but it's called God winks. And it's one of those things that could not be a coincidence. I'm sure everybody listening to this has had those things in their life when they look back and say, wow, why was I at that place at that particular time, and that particular person came into my life? And if I hadn't been there at that second, I would never have met that person, or whatever it is that happened. And we all have those kind of events that are there. I don't believe they're coincidences. I believe they are meant to be. And a fellow by the name of Squire Rushnell wrote a little book called When God Winks. And I love that kind of phrase of how it is. And so I sprinkled through my book many, many times when I describe something as a God wink, where something happened, like getting my friend that played the song on the radio first time. When I met my friend, his name is locally, his really good friend, Bob McHone, and he's a dear friend of mine. I had forgotten that he even had a radio program. We were having lunch together one day when I was back from Nashville, on a totally different topic. I hadn't even thought about talking to the music with him. And at lunch, we talked about it, various things. And I was telling him about my trip to Nashville and recording Rachel's song, and he got all excited. And so I think that it was divine connections here, where I had it at lunch that day with my friend Bob, and he ended up listening to Rachel's song, becoming so enamored with it that he played it on his radio program. And that radio play was what launched Rachel's song around to be played on every radio station, easy listening, in the entire United States. And so that was, again, one of those, quote, God winks, you know, the things like, you know, a lot of people, when they can think back, well, where did you meet your wife? That's a kind of a common question for married folks, is where'd you meet your wife? And those almost always make for a wonderful God wink story of, you know, the who introduced who to whom, and or those circumstances that came together for you to meet that person. And also, you know, other milestones in your career, whether you're changing career to go to another job, or you got a tremendous opportunity to do something, or entrepreneurs, you know, where did you get your idea for your business that you started as an entrepreneur? Where did that come from? Those almost always make for a wonderful God wink kind of story. And so my journey with my music is one of just one God wink after another, of places, things that have happened, people that I met, and things that occurred because of my music or whatever, that would never have happened if it wasn't something that I initiated. I happened to be at the right place, the right time, with the right person. Like the playing and selling of my music in gift shops. I had no idea. I'm about to lose my video here. Let me get I want to go here. Let's see. Tell me back. I had no idea how I was going to sell my music. I had tried gift shop, the record stores. I had approached the big record companies and that kind of thing, and they wouldn't even give me the time of day. And so I was kind of frustrated. I knew the song had appeal because I was getting all this feedback from the radio airplay. People heard it, loved it. And so I was really at kind of my wit's end. How am I going to sell my music? I know it has the people want to hear it. Well, the lady that I worked with at AT&T had a good friend. Her best friend owned a gift shop in Old Town, Alexandria. Now, Old Town is right across the river from Washington, D.C., and it's a tourist area, very historic town. Lots of tourists in there. And so she had a friend who owned a gift shop on King Street in Old Town, Alexandria. And the name of her gift shop was called America. She sold everything red, white, and blue, everything patriotic for Americana kind of things. And she had played music in her store. She played patriotic music. She had a CD player with nice speakers around the store, and she would play all this patriotic music. Well, Jane, my friend that I worked with, Leslie, said, I want to give my friend Jane a copy of your CD of Rachel's song. I said, okay, sure. I gave her one. And so she took it to her friend Jane. I didn't think anything about it. My phone rings one day at the work, and this lady says, hi, I'm Jane, and I own the gift shop America. And I need some help. She said, I play this Rachel song CD in my shop, and every time I play it, all the customers in my shop come over to the counter and say, do you have that music for sale that you're playing? I love that music. I want to take it home and play it. And she said, I don't have any. Can you sell me some at wholesale? And can we do that? I said, well, absolutely. So she and I worked out an arrangement of the wholesale price and whatever. And she said, can you bring me some tonight? I said, well, sure. So after work, I got home and Linda and I boxed up some CDs and cassette tapes of Rachel's song. And we went down. It was about a 30-minute drive from where we live down to Old Town Alexandria and dropped off a box of music for the gift shop, America. And I thought, well, that's going to be interesting. This is the first time we've ever been able to sell my music at wholesale to a retailer. We'll see. Well, two or three days later, my phone rings again. And Wanako, she says, Dave, this is Jane. I've got another problem. Those are all gone. I need some more music. I said, okay, I'll bring you some more. She said, can you bring them tonight? Yep, I'll be. So we boxed up. She said, how about doubling the order this time? So we boxed up a big box of CDs and tapes and took them down to Old Town. And, you know, she sold, Linda and I made that trip every week for a year, delivering music to that little gift shop. And she sold thousands of cassette tapes and CDs of just Rachel's song CD out of that one little gift shop. And now I'm a business person also. I have my master's of business administration, my MBA from Wake Forest University. And so I'm a business person too. And so I was always looking for the business model that was going to work to be able to sell my music. So I said, okay, now let's look at what happened with this one little gift shop in Old Town. Here it is. I sell her the cassette tapes for this, and I sell her the CDs for this, and she pays me they cost me this amount, and that's my gross margin of the difference. And I made a spreadsheet. And I said, okay, well, let's see. She sold X thousands of this and X thousands of that, multiply it all together, and down the bottom line is my gross profit. And I thought, well, okay, this is not bad. This is looking pretty good. And so Linda and I were thinking, well, what if I had one gift shop in every state? Let's not get greedy or anything. I've only got one now, but what if I had one in all 50 states? So I made my second column of my spreadsheet is 50 times the first column. And you look down the numbers and the bottom line gross profit. Well, now that is an interesting number. And then I said, okay, one more time. I'm not going to get greedy, but let's say there's 5 gift shops. This is a big country. You know, millions of people live here. So 5 gift shops in every state. Well, the third column is 50 times, 50 times 5, be 250 gift shops times the first column. And you do the arithmetic, and I looked down to my, I said, Linda, come here, you got to see this. This bottom line number down here, my gross profit from, if we do this, it's twice what I make at AT&T. So I said, aha, the light, it didn't take too long for the light bulb to go off in my head that, okay, this is what I've got to do. I have got to find 250 of these little gift shops like America in Old Town. And I know there are lots of gift shops in the country. And I later found out there's not just a lot. There were 75,000 gift shops in the United States. Now, we didn't have Google. We didn't have, or you could go online. The internet hadn't been invented yet. So I didn't have this online ability to find out where they were or who they were. But I could purchase a mailing list. And it was literally a physical computer printout mailing list that turned out when I got it, purchased it, it was about 4 inches thick, big wide computer paper, single spaced, run off on a computer, alphabetical within city, within state, all 75,000 gift shops across the whole country. And so I had already been trying to call gift shops around the country and doing it the hard way. We lived near Washington, D.C., and in Washington, D.C., we have the Library of Congress. And in the Library of Congress, they, at that time, had a room full of phone books. I don't know, you all probably don't have phone books there either anymore. I don't think we have phone books here either. But back then, we had a physical phone book. And in the back of it was something called the Yellow Pages that had all the business listings. And you could go to the gift shop listings in the Yellow Pages, and it would give you all alphabetical, all the gift shops. I went to the Library of Congress and I would pick out certain towns and cities that I wanted to call and made Xerox copies of the gift shop Yellow Pages of those gift shops. And I was calling and calling and calling, and it was quite a job to call all those gift shops on a weekend. I was having to do this after hours. I was still working. So on Saturdays and Sundays is when I would make all these phone calls. And after a while, I got tired of having to run down to the Library of Congress to copy Yellow Pages. And that's when I found out that I could buy the mailing list of all the gift shops in the entire country. And I still have that printout in a box over here somewhere. But it was a gold mine. I mean, every gift shop in the country was there with their name, their address, the phone number, the shop manager's name, and everything I needed. But what I didn't have was any kind of priority of who to call. I had noticed that when I was calling in big cities like Atlanta or New York or whatever, I wasn't having very much luck with convincing those gift shops to play and sell my music. Where I was having my luck was in tourist towns like Old Town Alexandria, or if you've ever been to Tennessee, Gatlinburg, Tennessee, big tourist town, nothing but gift shops almost. And so I was having a lot of luck there. And on average, I was having to make 30 phone calls to get one prospect. Now, for those of their entrepreneurs, you realize that sometimes your prospecting is a lot of blood, sweat, it's mostly sweat equity that you're putting in it. A lot of contacting. I'd have to get 29 people tell me no to get one yes. Well, that wasn't a very efficient way to do this. But I noticed that in tourist towns, I would get about every 3 or 4 phone calls, I would get somebody. It was like 1 out of 4 or 5. So I needed to hone my thing down to just the tourist towns. But I didn't know where the tourist towns were. Now, I knew where they were in Tennessee, where I was born, North Carolina, where I had lived, and then around Washington, D.C. But I didn't know in, for example, Arkansas or Idaho or California. I didn't know where all those tourist towns were. So I said, well, surely somebody has a list. Everybody makes lists of things. So I called Chambers of Commerce and Departments of Commerce. I actually contacted the Commerce Department in Washington. Do you all have a list of the tourist towns in by state? Oh, no, we don't have anything like that. So nobody had a list of tourist towns in any of the states. You just kind of had to know that was what was going on. Well, I didn't give up. For those that might suspect with my background, I'm a computer person. I'm a very analytical person. And I said, there's got to be a way to use, to be able to figure this out. Now, back then, we didn't call it big data or analytics. I don't even think those terms were probably even used very much back then. But that's what ended up happening. I said, all I need is two pieces of information to know where a tourist town is. I need to know how many gift shops are in that town. Well, I had that from my printout. You know, the printout, I could go down and I did. I went through the whole printout and counted how many gift shops are in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. It was 85, let's say. Then the second thing I needed to know was, oh, how many people, full-time, permanent population, live in that town? And because a tourist town is mainly supported by people that come into town, that's why they call it a tourist town. So you'd have a 85 gift shops and only maybe 2,500 people live there. Well, there's no way in the world 2,500 people can support 85 gift shops. And if you take the ratio of those two numbers, population per gift shop, that's an indication of how close something a town is to being a tourist town. So I built another spreadsheet. I went through my printout, put all those towns and states in a spreadsheet, and how many gift shops were in that town. And then I said, okay, now how am I going to find out the population of all those towns? Well, we have the United States Census Bureau, of course. And then I went to the library, and I'm sure this is true probably worldwide. If you ever want to know something, ask a librarian. If you know a librarian, those wonderful people, if they don't know the answer, they certainly know where to go get it. And so across the street from where I worked was the public library in Bethesda, Maryland. So on my lunch break one day, I went across the street to the library and asked the librarian, how can I quickly find out the population of various towns and cities in all across the United States? And she thought for a second. She said, oh, I've got the answer right here for you. So she said, come over here. She took me over to a book, a table that had a big book laying on it. And I'm going to hold it up here because those that are on video can see this. And I'll describe it for those that are listening. This book is about, I don't know, 15 inches wide and about 20 inches long, about an inch and a half thick. It weighs 12 pounds, and it's called the Rand McNally Commercial Atlas Marketing Guide. And inside this book are maps of all the states. And interestingly enough, it also has every little crossroad within that state in there. And guess what? It says what their census population is. So with this one book, I could look up every one of those little towns and put their population right in my spreadsheet. Now, that took a long time, as you can imagine. Wasn't computer. Today, you could do it online and Google it or whatever and create it almost instantly. I did it the hard way back then. But my spreadsheet, I did that. And as you know, with a spreadsheet, you can sort things and calculate things. So I had it calculate that ratio. What's the population per gift shop in that little town? And then I had the thing sort the entire spreadsheet by that ratio for every state. I wanted to know what are the towns that have the lowest population per gift shop. Well, Wanako, this was like, as we used to say, cream rising to the top. The ones at the top of the list were the Gatlinburg, Tennessee's, the Occoquan, Virginia, all these wonderful tourist areas. And every state that I didn't even know that were there, I knew that if they had a population per gift shop of, say, 50 or 75 or something, or less than 100, it's a tourist town. Has to be. So I started calling just those first. I'd go on a Saturday morning. I'd start on the East Coast, Florida, all of Florida up all the way to Maine, calling those gift shop towns in each of those states. And my prospecting went from 1 in 30 to 1 in 4 and 5. It was amazing. I had so many prospects by the end of the weekend that I would fill my car up with packages of promotional packages for them to consider my music, because I'd always send them either a cassette or a CD of Rachel's song for them to listen to and how to get a hold of me. And I built my business from that process to over 1,000 gift shops playing and selling my music. And by 1992, I was playing and selling so much music that I was able to quit my full-time job at AT&T and do my music full-time. And the story about how I came to that point in my life is also one that I wrote up in Guidepost Magazine. And it's just a wonderful testimony to persistence and following your intuition and maybe following God's lead in your life and leading you to where you need to be. But that's how I got from one gift shop to over 1,000. And it led me to a full-time career that I have never looked back. It's just been a wonderful, wonderful thing. And I hope I didn't make that too long of a story for you, but it's one of my most fun stories to tell.
Well, thank you for sharing that. It's amazing. You know, it shows how you became creative, right? You got these ideas, you got insights. You realized where your music was going to, you didn't give up. Like you said, it's a story of persistence as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's a important thing. You were following guidance, but you were also willing to do the work, right? To do what was necessary to get
there. Yeah, and it was a lot of work.
Yeah. So yeah, that's something that's very important on whatever journey we are on or whatever way we see the world is this willingness, right, to actually make the time, right, get that the time in your life and choose to do what it takes, right? And you were so willing to share the music, right, that you were willing to put all that work into it and you believed in it. And all those links, like you said, and all those feedbacks helped you to see that.
Yeah. And my advice.
And you had the training. And you had the training in the MBA. I mean, who has all of those cards in their pocket, in their heads, right? Like you did. Right, fabulous.
One of the things that I love to tell to the audiences that are full, usually of some people that are either entrepreneurs or want to be entrepreneurs, is that one of the secrets of success of anything you do is to take action. When you're studying my story, it's a story of having opportunities in front of you, where you come up to what I call a threshold moment in your life where you have to decide, do I go in through this door that's been opened for me, or do I just stay put? Taking action and stepping through that threshold and seeing what's on the other side is so important. You need to follow your instincts, your gut instincts, and follow the leads that are given to you to take action. Don't just think about it all day long. It's the world only things only happen when you take action. And so my advice is to, if you have an idea, a song, whatever idea you have that you want to pursue, whatever gifts you have, take action. Don't just think about it and keep them to yourself. I think the Bible says not to put things under a bushel, hide them under a bushel basket. You put the light out there for the whole world to see. And so taking action is so important. And if I had one thing advice for people, is that take your gifts, take action, and then give that gift away and see it multiply.
I think that's a perfect ending. So thank you so much for this conversation. And I'm so happy you came. And we've been planning this since a long time, right? And we had to figure out our schedules and get this all together. And now we've made it happen. So the two of us showed a lot of persistence as well. Just to get this conversation onto the World Wide Web.
Well, it's been a pleasure for me, Wanako. You're a fine host, and this has been an interesting program, and I'm sure the replays of this hopefully will be heard thousands of times, and I hope we've said something that will hopefully bless somebody's life.
I believe so, and that's why I'm doing this. I believe any of the many conversations I've had, each one of them has wonderful insights there for us. So I encourage you all to listen to as whatever you feel like listening to. I always have a short description of every episode so you can get an idea of what you want to listen to. But in my humble opinion or my understanding as a host, every conversation is magical, not magical, but amazing, you know, really full of, packed full of wonderful information and insights. So thank you so much for being one of my guests and providing these insights and these fascinating stories and ways of transforming a situation that seemed impossible to go beyond into a win, right? Because, you know, you had this situation where none of your music was being accepted by anyone, and you did know that it was getting out there. People loved it. And so that, and then you found another way. And the fun story about A Course in Miracles is that it also came about through the idea there must be another way. That was the idea. They were having, you know, all this conflict, those who brought the course into the world. They had a little lot of conflict in their institute. And then one of them was like saying, guys, there must be another way. And then the other one said, yes, I will help you with finding that way. And that's how that book came about. So, I believe you're a very beautiful demonstration of that understanding. There is a way. There is another way. So thank you so much for that. And I ask you all to subscribe to the podcast and the YouTube channel, and listen to it and share about it and let people know so they can profit from this work. And soon it will be 3 years that I've been doing this. So,
wow.
Thank you so much. And till next time.
Thank you so much.